Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Imagine this story. In 1995, a 16-year-old North Texas girl was left for dead in a field of wildflowers with an already dead student and the bones of several other victims. She survived the attack and tried to build a normal life for herself, but she never felt entirely safe, despite the fact that her testimony helped the police and prosecutors put the primary suspect on death row. As the execution date neared, she began to wonder, had they convicted the wrong man? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. That story, thankfully, is fiction, the product of lots of research and a terrific imagination by author Julia Heberlin. But the questions it raises about criminal justice and evidence and the reliability of our memories are serious and real. Julia Heberlin has worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and the Dallas Morning News. Her new novel is called Black-Eyed Susans. She is scheduled to speak about it Sunday at the Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. Julia, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
As this story unfolds, we are with Tessa, your main character, throughout, and yet there's a lot we don't know because there's a lot she doesn't know. And throughout the book, she tells us that she has told a lie but doesn't tell us what the truth actually is. How did you imagine a survivor who herself was still left with so many questions?
Honestly, it kind of came to me in bits and pieces, like all my novels do. You know, I started with the concept that you just read. And as a writer, to me, it's almost easier to leave things out, to kind of tease the reader, to tease myself, because I don't always know where my book is going either. And I figure that way I can surprise the reader, too. So leaving those questions was not a difficult thing for me. The difficult thing is wrapping it all up in the end, which, you know, I think maybe sometimes makes my editor lose her mind a little. That's why everybody needs an editor.
I was wondering about that because I was thinking as I was reading, and there it really is one of those books where every few pages there's like a, I didn't expect that moment. And you know basically what the resolution is going to be. And I wonder if it's a little bit like watching a movie like The Sixth Sense for the second time where you already know what's happening and therefore you – are you always aware of what's going to take your readers by surprise, or do you have to go back and ask yourself, will this still work?
Sometimes I do have to go back and ask myself. And, you know, there are two kinds of writers, the kinds who outline and the kinds like me who sort of let the characters drive the plot. So I'm not actually sure where the plot is always going because I want to be surprised and I want them to be surprised as well. So I did know the ending, but then I added another layer later. So and yes, I'm very aware that I don't want to cheat the reader, that I don't want to leave things hanging and then they reach the end and say, oh, that's not fair. I couldn't have figured it out because I'm playing a psychological game with the reader and I want it to be fair, but I want to win, of course.
Tessa does not remember the attack really at all. What the details she does remember are mixed up in her brain with what she is pretty well aware is hallucination, but she's not quite sure where the line is.
That's true, and I don't want to talk too much about that, but I do want you to wonder at the end of the book, you know, are there ghosts? Can you absolutely trust your memory?
The relationship she has with her daughter, Charlie, is great because Charlie is the one person who doesn't treat her in a strange way because of what's happened to her.
Yeah, it's very important to me to have hope in my books, and I think Charlie kind of represents that. And I used as a basis for Charlie's character a cousin of mine, a young cousin of mine, and my son mixed together. There's a line in there, I think, that's a sarcastic line about, Mom, just stop talking. It's not what you're saying. It's just that you're
talking.
Right. Yes, and those kinds of lines are so perfect. And I really do steal from lines from real life.
There's also it's so clear that the reporter in you is still raring to go. There's a lot of research here. I read an essay that you wrote about a trip that you took to Huntsville around the time of an execution to see what was going on outside the gates. And a similar scene, but one that has been fictionalized, appears in the novel. And I wonder if you can talk about how the process is different in writing something that is purely nonfiction, and then taking that and using it as source material for a fictional scene?
Well, you would think it would be helpful. The helpful part is that I know how to research, and I don't mind cold calling a famous death penalty attorney or a man who sat on death row. But But once you get into the book and you have to subtly weave facts and information and keep the voice and pace of the novel going, it can be a difficult ride. But the research for this book really started with forensic scientist Rhonda Roby. I was doing a piece for D Magazine on her, and she's one of the leading mitochondrial DNA experts in the world at identifying lost and old bones. She worked at 9/11 tirelessly. She's worked on serial killer bones. She's worked at mass plane crashes. And she and I became friends, and she's such a humane, wonderful person who says that her gift from God is that she's able to look at this stuff and not be grossed out about it, but she certainly goes home and thinks about it. So she kind of infused one of the characters in my book. I like that she has a twang and she's from Oklahoma, and she was inspired to do what she does when she was just a young girl in junior high and the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders were going on, a case that has never been solved and a case that still hangs in her memory, but that evidence truly is too degraded to ever know for sure who the killer was.
I was interested to learn that bones can reveal where we have spent years of our lives.
Yes. And, you know, my husband had clipped this article out of the New York Times about what is called isotope analysis. So I found that guy at the University of Florida, and he was fantastic. George Kamenov is his name. And the idea behind it, I don't think I can really explain it as well as he could, is that the elements in the soil and the air are soaked into our bones in proportion to what is in the soil and air of wherever we are. So there's sort of the memory of where we've been in our bones. Now, the difficult thing about this is it's not being used a lot in forensic science because they don't have a huge geological map from which to compare things, but there are certain things they can.
So at the start of this book, Tessa is reluctantly dragged back into confronting her past. She's never been able to entirely let it go, she, you know, likes to live away from it as much as she can. But the execution date has been set for this person convicted of attacking her. There are activists convinced he's not the right guy, and there are things that cause her to wonder if he's the right guy.
Yes, that's true. Now, I don't know how far to go here, but
you don't have to give anything away that you don't want to, but
I think, you know, Tessa is a very conflicted character, and I did that on purpose. I really did not want to preach about the death penalty. I just wanted to kind of lay it out. And I don't really know how I'd feel in that situation if part of my life had been ripped away from me or someone I loved had been ripped away from me. So I hope I wouldn't seek revenge or have mixed feelings about things, but she very much should have mixed feelings about things. And, you know, sometimes, and this sounds a little precious, but I could hear her say, you know, let me be who I am, not who you think I should be.
I thought it was interesting that she struggles with these questions because I think a lot of people who are, in theory, opposed to the death penalty think, well, I don't know, would I feel differently if someone I was very close to was a victim?
Right. I mean, I think the answer to that for me is probably that I just think it's a racist and unfair system. And so if it's a racist and unfair system, it doesn't matter. And, you know, David Dow, who I interviewed for this book and who helped me, who graciously, you know, put himself into the plot of my book and helped me, you know, go through the legal morass of the Texas system. Now, where was I going?
opposition, whether your opposition to the death penalty would remain steadfast if you knew someone, were
right,
close to someone who had been a victim.
Right, right. And, you know, basically, he sort of says that being innocent, or that we have a lot of innocent men on death row, is not a particularly his reason for being against the death penalty. It should be because most of the people on death row are guilty of horrible things. It should be because the system itself is unfair.
The other weird burden that Tessa deals with as an adult, and the book goes back and forth in time from around the time of the attack until to the present day, this idea that everywhere she goes, people remember this giant headline grabbing case, and it's become something that, like, on its own makes her somewhat paranoid. Like, do people just know that she's the lady, you know, trying to buy bread at the store, or do they recognize that she's one of the media call them the black-eyed Susan, the
right,
victims in this case?
Yes, I wanted from the beginning for them to be known as the Black-Eyed Susans and to be known in serial killer lore as that. And I think it makes her a more complex character because I think you can see, you know, part of yourself in that. Would you feel that way? We all feel a little paranoid and insecure sometimes, but with something like this, you know, definitely.
She has a friend as a teenager who is very important to her. They grow up together. So interesting because we know from fairly early on that they are not still in contact as adults, but we don't know why. And I found that portion of the book, I wanted that resolved as much as I wanted the main sort of mystery resolved.
Do you think it was successfully resolved?
Well, I guess I won't comment on that, but I wanted to know why they had a falling out.
Yes. I mean, I do leave a number of questions along the way on purpose. And if people criticize my work, it's generally because I have too many questions and too many themes. And I do that because every reader has seen every episode of Law and Order and CSI, and I need some distractions. I need different mysteries thrown in along the way, not just one straight rush to the end.
What is your relationship to CSI and other mysteries and similar works of fiction? Do you are you concerned about consuming too much of that, or does it serve as an inspiration, or does it serve as like a cautionary tale, like don't do this old trope again?
Both, probably. Some of it is inspirational. And when I'm writing, I don't mind if I need to pick up the pace of something. I'll read something very pacey and fast and lots of action. And that really seems to help me with my writing. If I'm struggling with words, I'll try to read something more lyrical, like The Beautiful Ruins or, you know, something by John Irving. And that seems to help, you know, improve my writing. So.
What is it like to set a story of serial killings in your hometown?
Well, these are not exact. Well, it's not exactly my hometown, but it's close.
The place
yes.
where you live.
Okay. Well, I really wanted to drop in little surprises for Fort Worth readers who have always been such great fans. So, you know, you'll see the Kimball and the Amen, and of course the Center for Human Identification on Camp Bowie, where I did my research with Rhonda Roby, which is one of the best labs in the world at identifying old bones. They even identified one of the victims of John Gacy, who was known as victim 19 until they made that DNA match.
I thought it was fun because, you know, I guess we always plug in familiar places even when a novel is set in a place we've never been before. We sort of imagine things we know. But in this case, I could actually picture the location.
Yes, that was nice. And I was in an event last night and they were talking about that. One person says she has to stop the book and tell her husband every time she recognizes a name or a location because I do steal from real life.
Was there anything that you hesitated to reproduce in its real form within the book? A place that you wanted to change or...
In this book, more than I'd say any of the others, there's certainly more research, and I certainly tried to make it as accurate as possible. I mean, being a journalist, I really wanted the book to be authentic. So if I've twitched anything, it was just because I had to, but I tried very hard not to do that.
We're speaking this hour with author Julia Heberlin about her new novel, Black-Eyed Susans. She'll be speaking about it Sunday at the Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with novelist Julia Heberlin. Her new book is called Black-Eyed Susans. She formerly worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and the Dallas Morning News. She'll be speaking about her new book Sunday at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation now, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I think there are probably a lot of journalists out there who dream about leaving journalism to write novels. Very few are able to make that come true.
That's true. I was lucky. I had a husband who was actually urging me to do this, to quit and write a book, because he knew I'd wanted to do it since I was 15 and read Rebecca. So that's what I did. I quit, and it took about 10 years to get to this point. And it took probably, I'd say, at least three years to get published. And that's when I was concentrating on writing full time. There was no way I could be a journalist and have any creative energy left for writing at all. So I wish them luck, but I think they have to be able to completely commit to it as a job before it will happen.
I'm always really astonished about people who have the mental energy to do, but to come home from a day of doing anything else and then sit down and get a lot of writing done.
Yes, and some people can do that. I am not that kind of person, and it's a scary process because you are sitting there writing things. It's very, you know, existential. You're writing it. Will anyone does it even exist if you're the only one who sees it? That's how it feels. So, and then you know the rounds of rejection start, which is, you know, most people kind of hope they'll be the breakout author, right? Well, that happens to what, 1.111% of people? It's unlikely. Most of us are going to have to toil and get rejected and then pick yourself back up. So, and there's always just a little bit of hope dangling out there for you. But if someone had told me how difficult this process was going to be before I started, it's sort of like having kids. People tell you that and you think, well, I'll throw them in the backpack and we'll be in Europe in 6 months.
Right.
But that's not the way it is at all. And that's the same with writing.
Do you feel like each time you write a novel, you're learning how to write that novel, or do you feel like it gets easier over time?
It absolutely does not get easier. Each novel is very different, and you set out different challenges in each novel. And for me, I want a new challenge with each novel. I want each novel to be better than the one before. So the answer to that is no. I think it almost gets harder, although your writing gets better.
So you have many scenes in the book. They're divided about half and half. Tessie as a teenager, Tessa, that's just what she calls herself as an adult. I thought that was an interesting choice because in some ways she's the same person and yet she's not. She's really a different person, you know, years later when she's sort of built a different life for herself than in those reeling weeks and months after the attack.
Right. I set it up so you have Tessie on a psychiatrist's couch right after the trauma, and then you have the present-day race against time. And I was very cognizant that Tessie had to be compelling enough that you would want to return to her. And after you were left hanging somewhere in the current race against time. And I usually don't not like novels myself that go back and forth in time. And I don't like novels necessarily that have different characters, you know, shifts back and forth between a character's point of view. But I, for some reason, this is the way this novel worked out. And I hope I succeeded at, you know, keeping both parts rapid, I guess.
I thought it was great. And the pace is good from one to the next. And it does feel like, in some ways, separate stories of this person who is the same person.
Yes, I'd say that is absolutely true. I read texts on psychological trauma into the night, and I could just sort of hear Tessie's voice saying, "That's a ridiculous memory technique. I would not buy into that," you know. And she was one of the easiest parts of any book I've ever written. I was always eager to return to her, and I did write it, you know, past, present. I didn't write all her scenes first. So she was almost like a relief. It was just so much fun to write her.
It was interesting that she is visiting a psychiatrist not only because she's been through this trauma, but because prosecutors are trying to prepare her for going on the witness stand.
Right. And so you have doubts about everybody in this book, I'd say. Everyone wants something from Tessie. So I hope you're on our side.
What's it like to capture the voice of the same person at 16 or 17 and, I don't know, 35 or 38, whatever she is at the conclusion?
You know, that just seemed to be a natural thing. I can't explain how that happens, actually, in my mind. It's just, it's a little magic thing. That's my answer.
Are you, when you go into the process and you have completed your drafts and you're ready to submit to an editor, are you excited? Are you full of anxiety? Are you dreading the process?
Of submitting the manuscript?
Yeah, and knowing that it'll come back with some suggested revisions and some big question marks and whatever.
Right. Well, you're so relieved to be finished. That's one. But you are not finished, and you know you're not. I mean, I have a somewhat legendary editor at Random House named Kate Misiak, and she does not let go of a book until she thinks it's absolutely done, which is fantastic. At the same time, it can be a brutal experience, which is most people are not willing to go through that because the result in the end is so much better. But I do think that one of the benefits of me not being self-published is that I have that editor who's not going to make me look bad to, you know, anyone else. And I mean, she just comes up with things. For example, like I'll have written I wrote a critical part in the novel. It was about 12 pages, a chapter. And she wrote one of her red notes on the manuscript that said, you know what, why don't you just cut this to one page and scare the bejesus out of me? Now, that, you know, I had worked so hard on those 12 pages, but she was so right. So anyway, that's part of my story. I get little red notes all the time. My favorite was she's thrown up enough in this book already.
It must be fun to have an idea for a red herring, which all great mystery stories have, and know that you've just got a great one going. Is there something that are there a set of characteristics that you want when you want to make a particular character or characters seem suspicious, knowing that you're maybe leading us a little bit down a path that doesn't lead to the end?
Okay, that's a good question. I would say that I write that character the way I think they should be written, and then I go back and either add something in that I think I should, that so the reader won't think I cheated, or I'll take something out that might give them away. But I want to say that I have a process, and I do, but it's really the characters that drive the story. It is not always the plot that drives the story.
I think that was maybe one thing I really liked about it, because I cared about, like, I could have read another 300 pages about Tessa and Charlie and, her relationships. It wasn't only that this thing had happened to her. You feel like they're going to continue on after this story is over.
That's nice. I do like likable characters, and I like heroines who are, you know, brave and funny and messed up. So,
Tessa has had a lot of loss in her life, aside from the crime that affected her.
Yes. And I wasn't quite sure how much of that to put in, how much of a dark background should she have. One of the things I did put in, which is a little extraneous, is, well, I don't think I should tell you. I'm going to have to stop right there.
She does have some sort of quirky friends. There's a great next door neighbor who is, I wouldn't call her comic relief, but when she's around, we're sort of happy to see her. And do you have to think about, there need to be moments, even in a book with a lot of tension, that sort of break that tension?
Yes, absolutely. I want to put humor in my book. It's like life, you know, it's light and it's dark. And Effie was intended to be, you know, a relief. It's funny because she makes this pumpkin pie out of a real pumpkin, and she's a horrible, horrible cook. And a friend of mine, messaged me on Facebook and said, "Was that my mother's pumpkin pie?" So anyway, but
do you find that your friends read your books looking for clues to you? I mean, these stories are not about you, but do they think they can understand something about you? And would somebody who knew you really well be able to see things about you, the author, in the book?
I think they're less interested in me and more worried that I'm putting them into the book. So they will ask me, was this me? And of course, usually it is not. So
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the idea of putting a scene down in fiction and putting a scene down in nonfiction. You, as a journalist, have been trained to be an observer of things. And I wonder if once you started writing fiction, you realized that was great training for a novelist.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. You know, being outside the death house was a profound experience in a number of ways. And it was the night of Edgar Tamayo's execution. He had killed a 24-year-old cop. He'd shot him 3 times in the back of the head. And the victim left behind a pregnant wife, and he was a war veteran, and it's just a very, very sad story. And when I was there, there were also a number of motorcycle cops or retired cops who were revving their engines as the needle was going in and Edgar Tamayo was dying. And if you've never been to Huntsville, you can stand right up next to the building where the execution is happening. One of the things that just struck me was how few people were there, even for something like this. You know, there were not the Facebook screamers, and there were not the politicians. And so when I wrote a scene in the book, I really wanted it to be as true to life as possible, because I think a lot of people don't know what it's like to stand outside an execution. And the same would be true of how you gather mitochondrial DNA, you know, or what are really realistic techniques used with retrieving memory.
Did you consider applying to actually witness inside an execution?
No, I didn't. You know, and I think that's because I just thought it was invasive. I mean, all the way along here, I realize I'm writing a commercial piece of entertainment, you know, and I just didn't think I had the right to do that.
The book made me think, and I don't know if this was your intended purpose at all, but the whole thing that Tessa deals with, the being known as a black-eyed Susan and being sort of a media commodity. She's never made herself one, but people recognize her and the story's been told. And as you say, it's part of serial killer lore. It is always interesting for me as a reader, to read something like this, to enjoy it, and then think, this is a story, it's a piece of fiction, but maybe something like this happened to real people, and their stories maybe shouldn't be entertainment. And yet the lines kind of get blurred. You know, people get really obsessed with these true stories, and there were real people behind them.
Right. I know. That's so true. One thing that I think is positive, that at least in writing a commercial thriller for me, is that I hope that people are thinking, I leave the reader thinking about a theme of some kind. In this book, it would be the death penalty. In a previous book, it would have been date rape. Because I do think that commercial fiction is a way to get people to learn about a topic that they would not ordinarily get involved in. Like, you know, Gillian Flynn and Gone Girl, mm-hmm. and the dysfunctionality of marriage and all the little, you know, the selfishness and the insecurity that's in all of us in a marriage. And, you know, Dan Brown in Inferno making us uncomfortable about overpopulation. So I know the lines are blurred there, too, I think in a good way. But as far as all the true crime stuff, it's, you know, a steady, horrible diet, I guess I'd say.
We have an email here from Karen in California who says, can you explain how you organize your information and storylines before you start writing? A mystery has so many moving pieces.
Well, okay. So she's assuming that I'm organized. So, but I write and let the story go. And then when I'm stuck, I sit stuck for a couple of days and then realize I just don't know enough about whatever it is I'm writing about. It's always better to call somebody or stand in the place or whatever to get yourself moving again. So I have about a million Post-it notes. I'm researching as I write. I don't do all the research in the beginning. So
is it easier to call people up if you say, oh, and I'm also a journalist? Are they more inclined to talk to you or less inclined to talk to you? In other words, are people who are busy happier to help out an aspiring novelist or a journalist working on it on a piece?
You know, it's funny. I just think these people who are out there saving lives and doing good things are nice people. So I don't think anyone should hesitate to call them up and ask. And I did not use the fact that I was a journalist. I mean, obviously, Rhonda knew I was a journalist mm-hmm. from the beginning, but I didn't use that with further research because, you know, then there might be expectations for other things. I wanted to just say what I needed from them and ask if they would be willing to help.
Obviously, there is, you know, the time that it takes to become a really good writer, and there's some inherent talent. But I wonder if you know what stands between people who go, huh, that would be a great idea for a movie or a novel, and the people who say that and then actually make one.
I think, well, you have to have people around you who say, do it. And who believe in you. I mean, mm-hmm. that's really important. I can't tell you how important that is to any kind of struggling artist. You know, I that's probably my answer.
Is there a moment when you know it's done? Like as you're doing your own rewriting before you sent it off, submitted it to an editor, is there like a feeling that you start to get when you've polished and polished? Or do you just do this in sequence so that after you've gone over it three times, you know you're done?
I would say there is a point at which I think it's done. And then there's a point at which my editor says it isn't done. And then there's a point at which we both say it's done. And that's a beautiful moment.
We are speaking this hour with novelist Julia Heberlin. She formerly worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and the Dallas Morning News. Her new book is called Black-Eyed Susans. She will be in Dallas at the Wild Detectives Bookstore on Sunday to talk about it and sign copies as well. All right. We will come back to our conversation with her in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can email think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Julia Heberlin about her new book, Black-Eyed Susans. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Another person who inspired a character in your work of fiction is a man named Anthony Graves. Will you tell us about him?
Yes. Anthony Graves is a man who sat in prison for 18 years, 12 of those years on death row for a murder he didn't do. He was convicted of killing a family of six and setting a house on fire in 1992 in Somerville, Texas. And he was eventually freed with the help of a lot of hope and a lot of lawyer hours. And he graciously agreed to talk to me on the phone one day. And, you know, and the irony was pretty clear to me as I was looking at my glimmering pool and he was talking about the sights and smells of death row. Just a remarkably forgiving human being, not bitter, spends his life going around the country talking about legal reform so this doesn't happen to anyone else. And he asked me in return if I would just mention his foundation whenever I talked about him. So can I say that?
Sure.
It's his website's anthonygravesfoundation.org.
It has to be interesting to spend time among people who volunteer to do work for other people that, you know, the people who are trying to exonerate people who are not guilty. I'm so struck by their passion because this is really complicated work. There are people who are going to be angry that you're even trying, people who think that justice has already been served and you need to just let things go. What do you think is behind that kind of passion that people have to see justice done, whereas other people, if it doesn't directly concern them, it's pretty easy to ignore?
Right. I think it's very difficult work. And, you know, I remember, you know, when Jack Kevorkian was out there doing his thing, and he just was not an attractive man at all. But I was thinking, who else will do this kind of thing but a Jack Kevorkian? Because you just throw everything away. That said, you know, meeting someone and talking to someone like David Dow, you know, just the soul and the heart. His book, The Autobiography of an Execution, is a beautiful memoir of what it's like to be a death penalty lawyer. And in that book, you see, you know, just how death, you know, just covers everything in his life. But he manages to go on and fight the good fight.
We actually had him on the show to talk about it. And I remember the contrast between, you know, the work he was doing, and then he'd go home and he, you know, was trying to explain things to his son. And it's just complicated.
It is. I think he must hike a lot or be in nature a lot to you know, make life okay. So, but I know there have to be, you know, very down moments. There were with Rhonda Roby. You know, she said to me, you know, I can look at, you know, the semen on a child's SpongeBob SquarePants pajamas and then, you know, and examine it. But then I go home and it's with me all night. I'm thinking about what happened, or I'm thinking about the woman whose bones I just looked at who was in a plane crash, wondering whether she died right away, you know, whether she was in pain.
Are you a people watcher?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. I much prefer to be asking the questions and observing than answering them. So, yes. And, you know, just little phrases. Everybody has a great story. I'm the kind of person who will drift to the person in the room who's standing alone, because I don't particularly like crowds and because inevitably they have the best stories. So I like the ordinary people who are sort of extraordinary in their own little way.
Do you keep like a notebook, or nobody has a notebook anymore, I guess, except maybe former journalists. But do you take notes in your phone if you see somebody somewhere and think there's something about this person that I might want to use, you know, to form a character later on?
Yes, I would say a little bit. I mostly write down funny lines people say. And, you know, my husband came back from Market Street the other day, and an older gentleman was trying to pitch him to buy some strawberry cake. He was giving out samples, and he kept pitching him. And then he said, you know what this goes good with? The 10 o'clock news. And I thought, that's going to be in a book. You know, so all those little lines, I think, kind of help. But Texans are great at giving you material.
Do you think that you said you were originally from Ohio?
Originally from Illinois. I was born in Illinois.
Okay. Do you think coming to Texas and not having lived here your entire life makes you aware of aspects of the culture that people who've lived here forever don't necessarily see as Texan?
I don't know. I was 3 when I moved here, so I pretty much feel like a native. And yet I was raised by parents who were not native and who were very liberal and, you know, pretty intellectual. And so, you know, I don't know.
What are you suggesting here?
I like to think that I'm very much a part of Texas. And that in some ways I feel like I have to defend us to, you know, other parts of the country, that, you know, that we are a myriad voices, that we love Johnny Cash and Rachmaninoff, that we don't all have Botox and big hair. I mean, LBJ supposedly, when he flew over his ranch land in Texas when he was in Air Force One, his shoulders used to roll back. And that's how I feel about Texas. So sometimes I poke satirical fun at Texas, but you know, I'm one of them. So
how did you choose? Tessa has a really cool job. She's an artist, but not a typical sort of artist. She takes on these contract projects, and they're really very different one to the next.
She is, her career is based on a friend of mine who is one of the most talented people I know. She raised She raised four boys, all while she makes beautiful little jewelry. She created a steel staircase for the house, these beautiful curved cabinets. There seems to be nothing she can't do. She was just sort of a problem solver, you know, and yet everything she created was absolutely beautiful. So I think those people should be revered in the world.
What kind of reader were you as a kid?
I was a voracious reader. Our bookshelves, I started with our bookshelves at home, which had, you know, everything from Sister Carrie to John Steinbeck and the Pearl to, you know, Agatha Christie. And then some book called The Fly Girls, which was like the 60s version of 50 Shades of Grey, I'd say. My mother says she has no idea how that got there. But I like to think that I was very influenced by sort of a combination of reading mysteries and thrillers and good literature and then a little trash.
I think a little trash is okay now and then.
I do, too.
Do you are you a television viewer? You said you know some of the shows, but I wonder, I mean, if you only have so much kind of intellectual time in your day, how you have to sort of like work your media diet.
I don't watch TV at all in the day, but I will start watching around 10 o'clock at night, you know, House of Cards, you know, whatever. I'm addicted to a lot of shows. And one of the things I like about House of Cards is, you know, you can still fall in love with an evil character. And so I like the complexity of that. And that actually helps my work, seeing how other writers create characters.
I'm always interested in a show where you do, you become kind of drawn to someone that you know is bad. And there's that process of you telling yourself, well, maybe they're not so bad. And then you realize, oh, no, they totally are. And what does that say about
us?
Me?
Yeah. I don't know what that says, but it's very interesting.
How do you create a reading list for yourself today? Is it? It sounds like a lot is related to your work, but I wonder if you still have like release reading that you need to do.
You know, I take recommendations from book clubs I go to. They inevitably have something on there that I haven't read or something old that I think I should have read, and then I, you know, I read a lot of the popular fiction because I like to know what it is that's appealing to people and whether I think it's appealing too. Because writing a novel is really not about art all the time. You know, you're here to sell books. That's what the publisher wants you to do. So you have to kind of walk a line between writing exactly what you want to write and what you think other people will like as well.
It would seem hard to look around at the market. On the one hand, in hindsight, it's always so obvious that this is what people were clamoring for and this has sold really well. But do you want to sort of know what is likely to sell, or do you want to know what you want to write and then figure out how to make it something that would sell? Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, I did the first. I wrote what I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And then I was very lucky that this particular book had a time when dark thrillers are popular. But I mean, above all else, you have to write what is inside you. I mean, if you try to write like somebody else, that's a big mistake. But I think you can have sort of a general feel for things, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Have you had the experience of going somewhere and seeing someone reading one of your books?
You know, no, I have not. That's yet to
have
come.
Have you fantasized about it?
Yeah, I would. Yes, I would like to see one. Sometimes I'll hang out at Barnes & Noble and see if anyone is picking up my book. And occasionally they do. And I think, well, should I stop and say something? But I don't. But I've actually never seen anyone reading it unexpectedly. But
I don't think I could resist if I had written a book. I think I would want to camp out at Barnes & Noble in a lawn chair and tell people about it.
Yeah, I tell all my friends and family to carry them around everywhere. There was a girl in England. The book is sold in England, and she said she was in the subway, you know, holding the book, and that they were just fascinated with the cover. And it was clear she was beautiful. They were fascinated with her.
Are the responses different overseas? Where maybe this book about Texas that feels so familiar to us feels exotic to them.
I think it does feel exotic. And, you know, I went over there for a little pre-publicity, and I was worried I was going to have to defend Texas a little. I don't know. I just have this chip on my shoulder, I guess. They love Texas, and they were fascinated by the theme of the death penalty because, of course, they don't have the death penalty. So all of that interests them, every detail.
It is interesting to think about the death penalty from the perspective of other industrialized countries that don't have it, that to us it is something that even for people who disagree with it, it's something that we recognize exists, and it doesn't shock us in the way that it shocks people in other places.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, standing outside the it's pretty banal. I mean, it's routine. I mean, we've become good at, you know, executing people. And, you know, but the thing is, it is happening less because now juries in Texas have an option of choosing life without parole, you know, in a capital case. And most of them seem to be doing that. But you look, and the, of course, the drugs are not as available as they used to be because there's such an outcry about the death penalty, and pharmacies don't want to create them. But, you know, like Utah has gone back to the firing squad as an option if they can't get the drugs. So it's not out of our culture yet, but I really believe that it will be.
Do you find it strange when you're finished with a project to allow yourself to stop researching the thing that you were clipping out headlines for and pasting into documents for months and years?
Say that again.
Do you know what I mean? So like now you have completed this novel that has as one of its themes the death penalty.
Right.
Is it are you going to forever follow stories about that, or are you moving on to something else that you're paying attention to and looking for news of?
I think talking to David Dow and Anthony Graves and going to the execution, first I wanted to write an authentic novel, and now I want to be a more authentic person. Mm. So I do think I absolutely will follow it more closely. I mean, it's a sad thing that it took me writing a novel to get me to stand outside the death house because, you know, I had a belief in something, but I never did anything about it. So I'm not an activist. I won't be an activist. I won't preach. I don't preach in the book because I think it's better to just lay things out. But yes, that is something that's going to stick with me forever.
Are there people in your life that you are more eager than others to read your books when they're done? Are there people who you know will be honest with you, and maybe that's great, maybe that's not great?
You know, people ask me, "Well, what do you think of the reviews?" And I tell them the only review I care about is Rhonda Roby at this point because she hasn't read the book. David Dow has, you know, I want to make sure I got all her science right because she's a stickler for the facts. So, but she's quite busy and hasn't read it yet. So, as far as other people, I would like Kate Middleton to read it in public.
Maybe while being photographed on a red carpet somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
Well, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, thank you.
And Wild Detectives on Sunday, the bookstore in Dallas. What time is that event?
I believe it's at 6 or 6:30. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Julia, you can find it on my website.
All right, perfect. Julia Heberlin worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and the Dallas Morning News. Now she is a novelist. Her new book is called Black-Eyed Susans. Again, it was great to have you.
Thanks.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.